So with, you know, a year and a half invested, you've already replaced the job that you got right out of college.
Mm-hmm.
Did that feel good? Was it like any kind of a breakthrough moment, or did you feel like
yeah,
it wasn't
no, it
doing
felt great,
enough?
But you know this business, it's you don't actually feel good.
Yeah,
like I mean, you have moments where you do, and then you go to bed, and then wake up the next day, and you're like, well, let's see what the rest of this year is going to look like, you know, or what today is going to look like. And even today, I'm sitting there like, hey, what can I do to like inflow for real estate agents? You need to work on inflow, whether that's building relationships, expanding. Even seasoned people have to reassess a couple times a year and say, okay, if I don't get these referrals, if these deals that I have in escrow don't go through, or these listings don't pan out, what am I going to do? I need to work on inflow. So if you're going to be in it for the long haul, you always need to be aware of that. So I don't know. I'm always going to stay hungry, I hope, on that side of things.
All right, welcome back to the Pursuit of Property podcast. We are joined today with a family member of mine who has been gracious enough to give us some of his time. And I'm excited because I haven't heard the whole backstory about how he got into real estate. But with us is Sullivan Gross, the president of the Ag Division over at Pearson Realty. And we are grateful to have you here, man.
Well, good to be here. Thank you. Hopefully I can provide some knowledge. You guys are smart guys, so well, I'm sure you got your areas covered, but maybe I could tell you about mine.
I am excited. We know nothing about ag, and you are very aware.
Come on. So, you know enough from living around here.
Well, maybe. Yeah. Would you say?
I would say I am nowhere near seasoned in knowledge of anything ag.
We can
ag.
Test him later. We'll test Kate out.
Pass. I'm not taking any exam.
You didn't realize I was going to do the question.
I know.
Here.
Yeah.
That's it. All of a sudden.
The tables already. See? There we go.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Sully, let's jump right into it. I mean, you were about to tell us about it before the pod started, but you went to school and you went into ag after. I don't know anything about how you got started in real estate, except that you've been in it and you've been crushing in it. And I'm curious even how this all started.
Well, like a lot of great opportunities, it just kind of fell into my lap. Of course, I went to college. And then when I came back, you know, from Fresno, both, as you know, your cousin and I got married and been together since high school. So we came back here. All of our family was here. And I knew that if I was going to settle back in Fresno, I was going to likely end up in something ag related. I didn't grow up directly farming. That wasn't necessarily my background. My dad and mom were actually in the dairy industry growing up, and then they worked for farmers and stuff, and then they eventually segued into retail. Horn Photo, of course, local family shop. And so I grew up around family business. I grew up around a lot of farming friends. My mom's side of the family still has a farm, and I knew that was what I wanted to do. So I started to work for a company called Calpine Containers out of college, which is an ag packaging distribution company. And fun fact, my major at Cal Poly was industrial technology with a concentration in packaging logistics. So it's kind of odd.
Yeah. What a mouthful.
Yeah, I know. I just say industrial technology, but
I was gonna say, does it fit on the degree? Like with the emphasis?
I don't even know where it is, somewhere in there, but maybe they call it something else. That's what I remember. But so I had some, you know, background in packaging. So I was like, oh, I'll land this job. It was in the ag space, and they had distribution centers throughout California and Arizona. So I felt like it was a great start for me to kind of figure out the whole segue of how crops get harvested from Mexico all the way up through, you know, Washington and Canada is kind of the area where we sold product to growers. And it was packaging materials, like when you go to the grocery store, you buy your grapes in a clamshell. Anyways, but then I was there for 2 years, but about a year in, I started to meet some people that worked at Pearson Realty and started to talk to them. And growing up in athletics, you always bet on yourself, right? And if you wanted to be good, it was you that had to put in all that time in the background. And I thought, gosh, I should bet on myself. because, you know, I know my work ethic and I know my drive. I'm competitive, but also want to do it the right way, of course. And I really valued relationships. And in my previous job, I wasn't as much involved with those direct relationships. I was mostly helping others fill their relationship role. So, of course, that was 8 years ago now almost. And I decided to jump in as a green agent, and our president at the time and manager, Dan Kevorkian, gave me the opportunity to join the team, and then he helped mentor me and of course lots of other people at the company, and then I just have been enjoying it since.
In that previous role, you were saying you were kind of on the fulfillment side. So were you like behind the scenes, like making sure orders were sent out, or you were in a sales role of some
My
level?
Official role was a supply chain manager. So I would go meet with some of the customers, figure out like what products they wanted to, or new products they wanted to develop, whether it was labels and certain things. And then I figured out how to source those products, like which manufacturers were going to make it for us as a company. Since we were just distributors, we didn't really make much products. So I could figure out how to fulfill their new product and line that they wanted done for that new season or whatever new crops they were going to.
And what was life like outside of work life to make that jump from what I assume was a W-2 salaried clock in, clock out type of job to then jumping in feet first into something brand new that was not guaranteed? I mean, what else is going on in your life at that point? Was it pretty easy to make that jump and transition? Obviously, you had that mindset of betting on yourself, but what were if any struggles that you encountered with making that jump?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I had a house, no car payments, but we had, of course, a mortgage. I was freshly married about a year in, and my wife, Erin, worked at Children's Hospital. So she had a steady income. And then we'd built up some savings. And of course, I like to look at the numbers like you guys do too. So I calculated, okay, what's my 3-year ROI and then 5-year based off my current projection. So I estimated what my income would be if I stayed in the current position and then what I expected to make, which was a low threshold the first year, second year, and then kind of like a steeper curve after that. And I said, at the end, okay, if I'm going to do this, and I talked to my wife about this, then, you know, we have X amount of savings. This is my baseline to survive and all of that. And then if I can hit these benchmarks, I'm committed to this for 3 years. That's what I told myself. I'm not picking my head up from this career for 3 years. And really, it should be 5 years. And I said, 3 years is just to pick my head up to see if I'm somewhat on track. And then 5 years is to determine if this is going to be a long-term career for me. And, you know, first year I, you know, surpassed my benchmark just slightly. Then the second year I surpassed the last year quite a bit more. And then it was like, I was somewhere around 2 years. I was already up to where I felt like I was getting a return on that change in job career. Plus there are so many other benefits to being a 1099 at the time, even before setting up the corporation and bearing a lot of the expenses. That wasn't in my original calculations, but that makes a big difference.
Yeah. And people hear about tax benefits and write-offs and they don't understand how it's used, why it's used, when it's best used. But if you're making money, it's much better to be that 1099 than a W-2 being a doctor where you're making $1 million, but there's no real way to shelter any of that.
Yeah. I've had that conversation with friends, Uber drivers. It doesn't matter. I tell them like, hey, if you're thinking about this new job, tell them you'll take a 1099. I said, because if you want a company car, that's cool, but I'd rather get 30 grand a year bump in my pay than this new Ford pickup truck. Because I run the numbers for him. Look, then you can ride off all these miles. You can do all these things. And then you own the pickup truck at the end, you know. But some people just don't like to think that way and that risk. But once you've done it and gotten your feet wet in it, like there's no other way.
A bit addicting.
Yeah. Of course, never make decisions for write-off reasons. That's very, very important. Preface.
Good advice.
Yes. Yes. But it is helpful when you look at the whole perspective.
Well, and you've been in it now, you said, coming up 8 years already?
It'll be 8 years later this year.
Yeah, see? And yeah. So you've been doing it for a while. I am going to take a guess that this has played out better than your initial conservative estimation.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And looking at it, my understanding of ag is just the, you know, we think our timelines are long, right? We tell people in the business, give yourself 6 months to kind of start establishing some clients, getting into escrow, getting your first paycheck. With ag, is it 2 years? Like, what does that
probably
look like?
Probably 2 years.
To really start getting any level of...
It's so hard. I remember, and I should never compare to myself, but like, I remember being at 6 months and being like, okay, like, I get it. Like, I kind of get the lingo. And of course, I was in an office where I could hear other people's conversations. So kind of like, okay, how would he respond to that question? And I was in an environment that helped me learn very quickly. And then, of course, being involved with some deals, I was getting my bearings under me and saying, okay, about 6 months, I think I know what questions to answer, and other ones that say, I'll get back to you, right? It's pretty simple.
Right.
And so I felt like I could start doing some of my own deals at that point. And then, of course, over the next few years, I started to do some of my own, but then we partner on a lot of deals, like you guys probably do too.
Yep.
But I would say for realistic expectations, 2 years. And we usually tell green agents that they should probably have another Pearson Realty agent involved for every one of their deals in the first year. And that's not a hard date or timeline. Sometimes at 6 months we reassess, but that means if Pearson Realty agents representing the seller, they can represent the buyer. Cause now I know that they have a team. And if not, there have been people where I'm like, hey, just run with this. And I'm here if you need me, just to help, you know, with any hurdles that may come up.
Yeah. When you hit the inevitable bump in the road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and for those who aren't familiar with ag, even, you know, myself included, can you just give a quick breakdown between, obviously a lot of people listening are familiar with a retail sale, right? Mm-hmm. Or purchase, right? Most everybody listening or watching know somebody who's bought or sold a home on the retail market, right?
Yep.
For ag, in a quick synopsis, what does that look like, either sale or purchase? Is it very similar, except it's obviously dealing with maybe some bigger numbers, or how does it compare to your retail sale or purchase?
Well, I don't want to give away some of the simple parts of it, but they're less paperwork typically because they don't have homes on them. There's no formal inspection. But really, a normal due diligence list for a buyer is, you know, do a pump and well test, find an old well completion log, probably call the irrigation district to confirm it receives water, how much water it's received, all the water details, which we could get into. Then, of course, if there are boundary things like surveys, ALTA surveys, those can be somewhat important. And then the other ones are fairly basic. Questionnaires, disclosures, yeah. Prelims. And so it's pretty straightforward.
And the asset that's getting transacted is usually going to be like bare land or fruit trees or
yep.
animal land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Grazing land. In like the grazing land scenario, I mean, is it just the land that gets sold, or is it the business with the animals? Like, what does
no,
that
it's
look
just
like?
The land.
Really?
Yeah.
So when I'm driving kind of down one of those country roads and you see, you know, for example, like in Madera, you see like a huge plot of land, you see a ton of cattle out there.
Yep.
Is it typically going to be different people that own the actual cattle versus the grazing land, or do a lot of businesses kind of have vertical integration where they own the land that their animals graze? Like, what does that look like?
Most of them, at least in Madera, are longtime ranching families. So they own the cattle and the land, and they've owned it for a long time. It's also very common when you get into other parts of the valley where you drive around, you see cows, they're actually owned by another neighbor. And the neighbor just lets the cows graze on the other person's property, and they pay, you know, some kind of
like
rental
a rent
fee.
Or yeah.
But it's like very minimal. Like a fairly high rental payment is like $20 to $25 a head of cattle a year.
Wow. And is that just because it's a symbiotic relationship? They want their land maintained?
Yeah, the cows are helpful.
Yeah.
They help chew the grasses. Typically, the cattle rancher will help maintain the fences, maintain the gates, you know, water infrastructure if there is any, maybe set up some springs and some troughs and things. So they'll do some improving too, and which is normal.
Say I called you because I wanted to buy, you know, some ag.
Yeah.
Say we're just looking for something that's easy to find and we find it day one. Mm-hmm. And you and I write the offer and it's like, great, you're in contract. Mm-hmm. How long until I own that property? Is there like a standard time range?
If you're getting a loan, it's 90 days. If you pay cash, it's whatever you want, 10 days.
So are most transactions?
But most of them are, you know, that 90, 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
Oh, so most are cash?
A lot right now are cash. Yeah, I'd say most of them are cash, but we're definitely doing ones that have finance contingencies. Those are 60 to 90 days, most likely, for standard loans.
Well, looping it back to when you were first starting, I mean, you got some clients, it sounds like, fairly reasonably early. You had some success. At what point did you start kind of going out on your own and feeling like you had a little bit of wind under your sails where you could handle this and, you know, management could take more of a back seat?
Yeah, well, our training model is fairly sink or swim.
Of course.
Yeah.
Welcome
to sales.
Which I think
most real estate is, but we don't have the influx of new agents enough to have like a set training program. Of course, there's a lot of dialogue between management and new hires. So there are check marks along the way. But like I mentioned, probably about that 6 months was like, okay, I think I'm getting this. Like I know how to handle things moving forward, but I don't know if I would say I'm ever comfortable, you know, maybe by this point I'm comfortable, but, and just confident in what, you know, referrals may come in, what new business is there. But those first few years, you're taking every single opportunity you can, right?
Yeah.
Small little properties.
Yeah. Horrible I've sold, clients.
And I've sold stuff that, you know, even the last year or so, you know, I don't want to call them pro bono, but they are that, right?
Yeah.
Like they're, you know, $36,000 lot that's, you know, sold somewhere in the middle of nowhere that someone just needed someone to help them find a buyer. And so we did that. Yeah.
What did prospecting look like in those early stages? Like you mentioned being a new agent, especially in ag versus maybe if you're just starting off as a traditional new agent in retail, what did that look like for you in the first 6 months to even, like you said, year and a half, 2 years of just going out and trying to find clients?
Yeah. Well, for me, I didn't grow up with a heavy ag background. I had to learn a lot more of that. Like I had to learn, okay, what does a good almond tree look like? What are good almond yields? What is a good pistachio block? All of these things. But I was absorbing myself into it. So it didn't take long. You know, everywhere I went, like, oh, what kind of wine grapes are those? What kind of vineyard is that? Like, what are these varieties of table grapes? How's the market doing on table grapes? If I talk to a table grape grower. So it didn't take me long because I like it. And I still do. I still love talking to people about the market and their crops. But a lot of driving time, you know, for us, like I think my first year and second year is probably around 40,000 miles on my truck.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, because you want to go look at a ranch, and it's very important to look at ranches. And even so, if another agent in the office listed something and I'm like, oh, I might have someone interested, or I may know someone in the area that'd be interested, well, get in your truck and go look at it. Sometimes that's in Gustine or out near Harris Ranch or down in Bakersfield somewhere, Shafter or anywhere. So you just get in your truck and then, you know, a good salespeople know, all right, like, what am I going to do along my way? Right. I'm going to make some calls. I'm going to try and visit these other people that I may know along the way or call them and say, hey, I'm going to be in the area. I'm going to swing by. Who are you? You know,
that's exactly right. My reset.
But for me, Pearson Realty's brand is really well recognized in the ag space. So I knew even if I was green and I maybe didn't know much, walking in with that business card will at least get me
a conversation,
at least a quick conversation. And I did that quite a bit. I wasn't the best at just dropping in. Because as you guys know, it's hard. And cold calling, I don't know if I would say I've had a lot of success with cold calling, because farmers are so relationship driven. They want to meet you in person, and they're fairly guarded. Mm-hmm. But I think there is a way to be successful with cold calling too. And there's efficient way with your time. But for me, it was driving in. And as hard as that is, you see some trucks at the shop, well, drive in and see who you're going to meet there.
Introduce yourself.
And say, you know, especially if you had a listing in hand that's for someone in the office nearby, say, hey, we have this ranch listed, you know, a mile down the road. But you want to be ready to be able to talk water, talk sales, everything, and talk those things. So I sometimes overanalyzed all the information, but I wanted to show that I was knowledgeable before I went, if I even saw that person. Of course. There's a lot of, no pun intended, just wheel spinning. That's a part of the business too.
Well, and I think it's interesting what you said about you enjoyed it, you absorbed yourself into it. I feel as if I'm still in a phase where, I mean, I tell Cade this, I very often dream about work. And it's like an obsession, because I'm still in a phase where I feel like I'm brand new. You know, we're 6 years deep or 5.5 years deep, and I still wake up and there's a new problem I've never seen before. And so it's like my brain is constantly thinking about it because I enjoy it. It's kind of problem solving.
What are some recent issues you run into that, like, give us an example of kind of a hurdle that you've been up against?
We bought a property in Hanford from a retired veteran who had inherited a home through probate. And you know, my siblings are Army. He was a Ranger. I felt like we had good rapport. He's the first seller that ever, when I offered him a price, he said, let's do $2,000 less. I know that you're pushing it. Let's just make sure it's a win for you. I called Jason, man, I killed it. I called my dad, man, I killed it. I called my brother-in-law, Colin. Bro, I name dropped you. Like, this guy was cool. 2.5 months later, somebody had broken into the home saying that this was a fraudulent sale and that it was their home. Obviously, I am going with the honorably discharged veteran who had the court paperwork to prove it, that cleared title. And then 8 months later, we got a call from the local DA saying, nah, that was fraud. He's about to get arrested. It was a whole ordeal. We had $100,000+ tied up. And Jason and I were like, well, I've never seen this ever in my life. I would never have guessed this was the outcome.
Wow.
So we had to figure out how to deal with title insurance. And so that's an example where I just never even thought it would happen.
Yeah.
And you just kind of have to think through, what do I do next and what's the next step?
Wow. That's a new one.
Yeah.
Obviously, the title companies.
Yeah. I don't want to get into
the bankruptcy documents, obviously.
No, he didn't forge it. I think he did something. We didn't get full answers.
Yeah, I don't need to get you something.
At the end of the day, title insurance did kind of pull through. It took a long time. It was
very long time.
It was kind of monotonous, but
interesting. Yeah, that's a major challenge.
We've done hundreds of transactions. We've always paid for title insurance and never used it.
That's why I have it.
Well, it didn't think, you know, you would, and always thought if a situation like that popped up, it'd always be caught before getting to the closing table.
Yeah, I wouldn't think it comes up a year later, but so that's an example where
that's
a
good answer.
I'm excited about it. It's something new. There's a part of you that's like, this is kind of fun, interesting. There's a part of you that's like, oh my God, is this like the worst thing that's ever happened to me?
Yeah.
Usually it's not, but your brain spins on it and you really try to digest it. But you did that with the crops and learning all these different things.
But I can relate to that. I still, you know, I remember, you know, some people say like, oh, it's just your job. You kind of have to suffer through it. And I kind of keep quiet on that comment because I feel like I'm at a place where I don't dread at all working and I enjoy it. And you guys do too, of course. You can tell it in your energy and wanting to do podcasts and different things to educate people. And same thing on Sundays. I look forward to work on Mondays. In the mornings, I look forward to going to work and love it because I feel like I am learning too, and I'm helping people, but I just am in a good spot. I feel like, so I like it.
Well, it's good to have you on here talking, because a lot of people right now in the recent podcasts have talked about the difficulty. And so we haven't had as many people that are in a spot where you're saying where they're excited. There are a lot of people that we've talked to are coming in kind of in that grind mode.
Well, and that leads me, I'm curious to ask, right? Because when you first jumped in, you kind of gave yourself that 5-year plan with kind of those benchmarks, you know, at the year mark, the 3-year mark, and then kind of that 5-year mark. Obviously, now you're coming up on the 8-year mark. Do you have any sort of benchmarks now that you're looking at? Obviously, you're in a space mentally where you love what you do. You love working with your clients, the industry that you're in, the position that you're in now, being the president of the Ag Division. Do you have any sort of roadmap or any, you know, cost analysis that you're doing where for where you want to grow or where you want to be over the next couple of years? Or are you kind of in cruise control mode?
Well, there's really nowhere up within my organization to go from here, which I'm fine with. And, you know, I think, you know, of course we have where we'd like to be, every year. And I still have, I think you guys do too, these break even and benchmark points.
Of course.
Yep, then you have, it's natural. And then, so you have your break even numbers. And of course I tell my wife about this cause she has no idea about any of the finance. I don't even think she knows where to log into the bank account. I'm serious. Like, I think we switched to Fresno First Bank a few years ago and she still hasn't gone in there to even get the login. Like,
that's hilarious.
Verify that we've opened it. So
there's trust there. At
there
least
is, but I feel like obligated. Like I have to tell her like, all right, these are like our break even cause we farm too. So we have farm expenses. Mm. So we know where all of that stuff is. I do. So I have break evens. I have where could I live comfortably currently without any kind of growth? And then if everything of course above that's cream to try and, you know, expand on whatever investments we're doing. And for us, we have most of our you know, our investments are in ag.
I was going to ask about that. When did you make that jump? We saw a statistic the other day talking about the number, the percentage of realtors that invest in residential homes, and it was minuscule.
Oh, really?
It was 45% of agents don't own their own home. And then it was like 5% own one home outside of their primary. And then it was like less than 1% own more than 5 homes. And so we didn't understand that because we kind of grew up in the business being told, invest.
You guys came into the investing side.
But on the ag side, that's an even bigger leap, just bigger assets, bigger risk. That's not as simple where it's you buy a house and rent it. There's, you know, it's a business.
Yeah.
So how did you even build up the confidence to go pull the trigger?
I met a couple people, farmers that were mentors for me to help with our first one. And that mentor and friend still farms that property and another one that we have in that area. But they helped us, you know, get the confidence in the numbers, and they helped with the farming side because that was one thing that I didn't want was it to take away from my day job in Pearson Realty. I didn't want to spend too much time on it. And also didn't want the perception from sellers or buyers to be like, oh, Sullivan's out there working on his farm. He should be working on selling my ranches.
Mm, right.
And so I never wanted that, or at least was aware of that. And so I don't spend any time really on those things during the week. You know, I do spend time on the weekends. Like I was out at one of our properties that needs a renter on it in the house this last Saturday. So, you know, I do spend a little bit of time on it. But my first one was kind of that first leap. And then the second one was where we live now, which, you know, I talked to you a lot about that. And so we wanted a place that was outside of Fresno that had a little house that we could fix up. And so we found that. So our first one was in 2020. Second one, I think, was 21. And then we have another one that we bought in 22.
In 2020, you were how many years into the business? That would be four and a half.
Yeah.
I mean, were you scared when you did it, when you bought that place? Did you feel confident? What was it like emotionally putting your money where your mouth was and buying ag and taking the leap if you've never done it?
Well, I was confident in my friend that farms it, so I knew at least that would be covered. And I knew about buying farmland, right?
So you felt pretty good about the whole thing.
I was fine with it. The one question mark was like, how does it affect the accounting and write-off side of it? Because you never really know that until the first one, right? So So we got through that. And
did that work out better or worse than you initially expected, the accounting side?
Better.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's a big reason I've heard to buy ag is there's a huge advantage, you know, with it being so volatile.
There
if
was.
If you have another job that's pretty consistent, that can be useful.
Yeah. You have to obviously have income. And there used to be, you know, you could accelerate improvements on farmland at 100%. And then, of course, the laws passed. So now it's this year, it's 60%.
So is that the same as that law that was for the farm equip? Is the same law the one that people were using for cars, where if you bought a 6,000 pound car, you could write it off 100%, but now you can't? It's like only a fraction?
I think it's, or are they different? It's the same, but it's pretty much the same schedule.
Concept.
Yeah. And obviously I'm not an accountant, but my accountant is very, my accountant is very heavy into investing and into ag. And so he's helped us feel, and he's been a huge, major resource for us. So
I'm just curious, you seem like you kind of kept track of your progress after a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. You had like the initial assumption. At what point did you pass the W-2 job that you had to begin with? Because that has to be a big benchmark, like a proof of concept when you pass your original income. Did you pay attention to that?
Yeah, I think it was like 1.8 years or something like that.
So with, you know, a year and a half invested, you've already replaced the job that you got right out of college.
Mm-hmm.
Did that feel good? Was it like any kind of a breakthrough moment, or did you feel like
yeah,
I wasn't
no, it
doing
felt
enough?
Great, but you know this business, it's you don't actually feel good.
Yeah,
like that's I mean, you have moments where you do, and then you go to bed, and then wake up the next day, and you're like, well, let's see what the rest of this year is going to look like, you know, or what today is going to look like. And even today, I'm sitting there like, hey, what can I do to like inflow for real estate agents? You need to work on inflow, whether that's building relationships, expanding. Even seasoned people have to reassess a couple times a year and say, okay, if I don't get these referrals, if I these deals that I have in escrow don't go through or these listings don't pan out, what am I going to do? I need to work on inflow. So if you're going to be in it for the long haul, you always need to be aware of that. So I don't know. I'm always going to stay hungry, I hope, on that side of things.
And you're competitive. You like to compete with yourself. Like just because you had a good year doesn't mean you're never going to do it again. It's how do I do that again, but better? I'm guessing.
Yeah. And everyone wants to make, of course, have a growth path every year of making more and more. But, you know, I think in our consuming world, everyone has to pick their head up and say like, wow, like if I could redo what I did last year or 70% of that, then I'm still going to be happy.
Yeah. Right.
Well, and it's not like too, like you hit that benchmark, whatever, 1.8 years into the business, but it's not like you said, it's not like the morning you woke up the next day, the red carpet was rolled out for you. You had the paparazzi there taking pictures and like nothing really changes.
No.
Right.
Yeah. Like when Aaron and I were first married, we lived in the house. We had no furniture. We just had like a hand-me-down bed, hand-me-down couch, all the stuff that most people do when they first get married.
I still have it all.
And we were just as happy, right? Like, and we're still happy now. So it shouldn't affect your happiness level, your income. I know that's kind of pretentious to say, but...
And they have all the studies that say after you meet your threshold of, you know, whatever it is, housing... it was shelter, food, and there's
base. Yeah.
Yeah. It's your like basic your baseline. Stuff. They say that there's really not a ton
as long as you're either a hunter or gatherer too, right? You can grow your own food and kill your own animals and skin them in the garage and stuff. Is that in this statistic?
It may have been. It may have been. I don't, you know, it was a long time ago. You know, I don't read scientific reports.
Well, if you need help, you can come. I can show you.
Well, let's talk about that. Because we're kind of winding down here a little. You seem like, you love what you're doing. I talk to you all the time outside of podcast, and it's always the next place you're going to, the next thing that you're getting into. You have a ton of cool hobbies. I mean, how has real estate just changed that ability for you to do some of these things?
Oh, man. I just meet a lot of great people that I get opportunities to go have fun with them, too. I have a, you know, a couple little trips, but we of course have young kids. So the trip planning is more, family related or local because it's harder with young kids. But, I've got a trip to Cabo coming up and a concert in Vegas, and I'm trying to figure out what my hunting plans are going to be later this year. I'm going to sneak some in there, but they're not like they used to be, where 2 weeks in Alaska with no phone on was doable anymore.
Yeah.
You actually, you know, I think you do more sales when you're on vacation anyways, but
it's been proven.
It's been proven every time, every time.
Yeah.
Anytime you're out of town is when you get that hot lead. That's like, I'm just ready to go. And you're calling people.
You just
can
forward
you
the purchase contracts? Hey, can you hand sign this? Yeah, exactly. So it's good luck, but
I mean, yeah. For the people listening, I've sent a few people to you that were interested in just getting started in the ag world.
Yes.
If you were to leave them with just an idea of kind of advice you'd have given yourself or advice you'd give them in the current market we're in, what would you say for that person on the other side of the camera that's just thinking about getting started?
How much time do we have?
As much time as you want. You still got plenty of time.
Okay. Because most of the people listening are investors in some form of mostly residential and some commercial real estate.
Right.
So the biggest hurdle is the risk with farming because it changes every year. Commodity prices change, the cost to farm change. And there are a lot of variables that are outside of a farmer's control. So usually when I get phone calls from people that say, I want to buy my first farm, the next question is usually why, you know, in a way that's like, what is your reasoning? Cause some people just want a place to go retire and call their own and tinker, and they're less worried about the income. In your guys' world and mine, it's like, okay, that's cool, but we also need to have income. And how are we going to project that? But I always tell people that farming, if you're going to invest in farmland, it's 10 years minimum is what you need to be looking at. So you can run all your numbers. We don't run the numbers because they're likely going to be wrong either way, because the commodity prices, we don't know what's going to happen with Mother Nature and crops and all these things. So it's too much liability for us to run, you know, some kind of pro forma. But we also test buyers to see how much they actually want to do this, because it's a learning curve to go from a set cap rate, or maybe you can bump rents up to a point. Maybe related is like, if I'm going to go buy this property, I'm going to go plant something else. So that's kind of similar in a way, and then that will add value to that property. So I would tell people it's a 10-year investment. You should commit to that when you purchase the property. And I always tell them, I ask, where do you live? Because farming, even if you have someone farm for you, you need to have eyes on the property. It's not something you just walk away from. So you need to be able to drive out there on the weekends. And when it's anything further than an hour, it's really inconvenient. And I feel like after a few years, unless you have a really good relationship with your farm manager, like, you just receive bills in the mail. It's like, oh, these people pruned your trees. Like, here's $2,000 bill. And you get in farming, you only get paid when you get crops that come off, and that's only once a year. And so you have all these bills, and it's hard to kind of model farming in some ways, especially if you have young trees that don't produce anything. Like, those bills just start stacking up. So you want to be able to say, okay, I got this bill they pruned. I should probably go take a look at it and see what they did, you know, just making sure all those things are good. So I want people to be within an hour at least, preferably less, than where they'd want to buy. I also ask, like, who would be farming the property? Would you be doing it? Would you have someone doing it? Who do you know that farms these crops? And they can say, oh, I have a family member. Great. Have them go with you to look at all these ranches, because they can help you project what your costs are going to be and potential income. And they'll look at things differently. If you don't know, you know, this has flood irrigation versus fan jets or drip irrigation. So all those little things help. And so I try to help build up their expectations and then get their advisor group, you know, start them thinking about their advisor
group.
Who
am I going to be?
I will be the advisor on the real estate side. I'm not going to be your farm advisor.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, though I could, but I'm going to think about things differently than them, most likely. Because even if I invest on my own time, my models might be different, or motivation. So,
and when they're getting into this, it sounds like there needs to be an expectation set that you need to have some padding, some runway with the bank account, knowing
definitely
that year one may not make money, you may lose. Year two, you may not make money, you may lose. And just having an understanding that if you're going to be in this for 10 years, the purpose is to give yourself enough time to start actually reaping some profit.
Definitely. Yeah. And with farms, the other big difference is lenders of farmland for property that is in a low, I call them low risk water region, meaning they have good water, just blanketly saying that. The most of the ag banks are somewhere around a 60-40 loan to value. Some of them will go 65-35, but it's kind of hard to get them to stretch from that.
So you're leaving a big chunk, no matter financed or cash.
So 40% of $1 million is $400,000, right? So that's also maybe a little different than your guys' world. It's more like 80-20, right?
You can get up to 80.
Up to 80.
I think usually the standard is 75.
Oh, it is. Okay, so yeah, there's not a huge difference there.
But it's but a much 15%, different price.
Yeah. Much different, yeah.
That's interesting.
And I always, the people are like, oh, I could, you know, I could swing using that scenario. $1 million property for, I'll put $400,000 down. Okay. How much does that leave you in your bank account? It's like, oh, well, it leaves me $50,000. Well, that's not going to work because these are almond trees and they cost $4,000 a year to farm.
Per tree?
$4,000 per acre.
Per acre.
To farm all the way from the last harvest through harvest. And that some people can do it for a little less, but let's just use $4,000 an acre. So if it's a 40-acre block, that's $160,000.
Just to get to the point where you even have a chance at making money.
Yeah.
And there's no guarantee that that crop's even going to yield a profit.
Correct.
Oh, geez.
And then you don't get paid when when the nuts get, you know, are harvested, they get shaken on the ground, then they get hauled off. Then usually you get a percentage of that payment.
Like 30% or something?
Maybe 25%. Or usually it's on a cents basis. You'll get X number of cents per pound. So you get a little bit of a payment, and that's enough for you to be able to pay out your harvesting crews and any of the contract labor, because that's kind of an expense that comes real quick. So they give you some money to pay them off, and then you sit there and wait.
And how do you know what you even made? Because almonds get harvested in fall, winter?
In fall, yeah. They get harvested really from late July through October. So then depending on your processor, most people are in the general pool, meaning the processor sells almonds throughout the year, and then they average out that price and pay the pool people that same price.
It's like a syndication. Yeah. Everybody's putting the same crop together. Whatever we sell it for, you put in 10%, you get 10% back.
Yeah. And then you leave it up to the experts to sell at the right time. Yeah. And usually they're selling throughout the year because you don't always know. It could go down. So there usually is some constant transacting. But then there are other people that are on the spot pay. So they take the market when they want. So the processor's telling, hey, Scott, you have 100,000 pounds that you need to sell. These are the prices this week. And you can decide, all right, well, are they going to be better next week? Yeah. Or maybe I sell half of it, or maybe I just wait. So then you don't get paid at all until you make that decision. So there are some people that haven't been paid on 2022 crop.
And it's because they're holding because of the commodity prices.
Because they're holding. They're getting charged like a storage fees and stuff. And the values, you know, go down. And it's not the actual nuts that they're saving there. They're just trading them in for someone, the grade that's the same.
Right.
It's like money in the bank. It's not the actual same dollar. It's someone else's dollar.
Because you can't leave the almonds from 2 years ago. They're just not going to be good.
So there's two ways. But if you're in, and some of the processors do it differently, but you could get paid, you know, right after they receive some of the nuts, then some around, you know, December timeframe. So you have some Christmas money, and then February is usually a third, somewhere around there. February or April is another third or fourth payment. So you don't get paid right away.
Oh my gosh.
Well, and it makes me think too, for the people who want to get into ag, like there still needs to be, just like you were brand new agent when you sat there and educated yourself for the first 6 months to a year and just absorb information. The people who are looking to purchase ag, unless they've got a kick-ass group of advisors who they're just going to hand it off to and let it run, there should be some time spent educating yourself on the asset class that you're going to go and invest in.
Definitely.
And each commodity is even very different.
And each water district region is different. I haven't even dove into the water, which I don't think is needed, but it's so complex. But it can be a pretty big hurdle for people if they don't understand it. But We usually sell several ranches a year to first-time people, and I can tell when someone is going to get it because they ask they stop asking the dumb questions at first. And they
like
start,
what I ask?
No. Yeah.
No, I saw you make eye contact.
No, not at all. And so we do sell them to first-time people, and there's some of those people are still farming those ranches and buying more. I think of course, if you're investing in farmland, you're putting yourself in that category, so you'll have other investments too. Once you've done it and on those other levels, I think you could figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know you could. Yeah.
It sounds like ag is a completely different beast, like what Cade and I thought. And I'm glad that we have a guy like you in our corner, because we get questions about it, and we get sellers calling us to sell us land, as you're aware.
Yeah.
And I didn't even think about the complexity of underwriting what a deal looks like, because there is so many variables.
Yeah. And of course it seems simple to us, just like your jobs, you know, at times seem real simple. Like it's X and produce Y, whatever. And I think the issue right now, just to kind of give everyone an update, is I think there's light somewhere at the end of a tunnel, but the ag space is in a little bit of a challenging environment, because we've had commodity prices, which I mentioned earlier, you know, ag values. So ag land is, and ag income is based off commodity prices. And the other factors for land values are, and some of these parallel with your businesses, of course, interest rates, and then other investments that may compete with the investor space. Cost of, you guys, it'd be cost of improvements. Mm-hmm. For ag land, it's cost to farm or cost to improve, like new piping to put into for irrigation system is high compared to what it was. And it's come down since COVID, but still has a ways to go. So the cost of farm, diesel prices, all those things affect farming. I said interest rates. And then the other one I didn't say was exchange rates, because we ship a lot of our products in California outside of the U.S. So tariff agreements and exchange rates between other countries can really affect things. If you have a country like China that buys a lot of walnuts or pistachios or almonds, that if we have a change in our currencies, it can really help them. Of course, tariffs too. So right now we have, just kind of blanketly, there are a lot of commodities that have shown signs that they're going to stay on a lower level. And even looking into like the next 12 months on some of these commodities, it looks like almonds may not climb out of their hole for another year, though I don't know that for sure. I still think pistachios are profitable, depending on your yields. But then there are other commodities that are just year by year. So I talk about nut crops. Well, nut crops have been the trend for a long time now, because they're fairly hardy. They're a little less labor. They are less labor. They're proven here, and there are other people that know how to farm them and know how to process them. So it's very common in the farming world to have a farm manager. So to find someone that is within a 4-mile radius of you that knows how to farm walnuts, almonds, or pistachios, if you weren't going to be the one to do it, is fairly easy. Now, when you get into annular, like specialty crops, like fresh fruit, that's a whole nother animal, because, you know, tree fruit may be good this year, but next year, who knows? It's like real estate, right? And then oranges, there are some varieties that are probably going to be more stable than others, but there's other ones that it's a year by year, or cherries, or pomegranates. They're all fairly different. So we work with obviously a wide spectrum of them, and they're all changing. But right now we're seeing kind of on average, more of them have been lower. So we are seeing a trend downward of land values, because a majority of the commodities are softer than we'd like.
So for right now, you're predicting this kind of somewhat depressed market is going to stay that way a bit. Maybe there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It's not crystal clear, but maybe some stuff's going to see a little bit of a break.
Yeah. So for this snapshot in time, I would say, for people, a lot of the numbers aren't going to make any sense. Like, you go find a real good almond block, I could tell you it's not going to give you a 2% return, right now.
Wow.
And that's with cash. Like, you're not going to get that. So right now, and that's in a good water area. Because the land values are so much higher in a good water area and more stable because people want to be in there, where there's high risk water areas, you can get them for cheaper. And I maybe say you can get 4%, but there's a high likelihood that some blocks, they're all going to be in the red right now. So that's what I say. I still think farmland's a great investment. If you look at like a 50-year projection on land values and the appreciation of farmland, it has surpassed the S&P 500. And that's mostly due to not your income from the farm, but your appreciation. Mm. So I don't know. I feel it at times. Once you've invested in farmland, it gets easier, but it's also year by year, and you have to look at it long term. I still think almonds are a great crop for people to grow within their portfolio, and pistachios, of course, too, and some other ones too. But I think there's so much opportunity out there, guys. Not just from the real estate space. Speaking on real estate, I think it's hard right now because we're in a depressed market. But we talk about this at our office. That's when they need us the most.
Yep.
Right. And you guys probably feel the same way. They can't just go to their neighbor in the ag space. Most neighbors are logical buyers, right? They just can't go to their neighbor and then fork over all cash to buy out another neighbor at a fair price. So they need us a lot. And we have to be students of the game and study all the sales, all the water, all the changes, all the commodities to make sure we advise them the best possible.
Yeah. And how to actually get that property sold when it's not as simple as just posting it somewhere and the buyer appears.
Oh yeah.
Well, yeah. And not only that, where our clients need us the most, but it's also where the most amount of opportunity lies for ourselves, especially mm-hmm. in the investment space when we're in kind of this depressed market, so to speak, or, you know, when a lot of people are going one way and a select few are going the other, it presents a lot of opportunities for the people who are educated and willing to put in the work and pull the trigger on something
and sacrifice exactly. maybe short-term gain mm-hmm. for long-term growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's a very, very good point. And you're smart to look at it like that. Like for us, you have to value what opportunities are going to give you money. Cause there's a lot of time you can spend, you know, with some people and though they people need the advice and the time, we're always happy to share that, but there comes a point where
you can't help everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I appreciate that you're honest about that. Like you and I have had conversations when it gets to a certain point, if they're not willing to hit these standards and they're not realistic on X, Y, or Z, it just doesn't make sense to continue the conversation today.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, with our market changing, we're getting a large influx of sellers and less buyers. So just natural. And, you know, we've been talking about at our company for months now that, hey, it used to always be sellers or who you wanted to work for, right? As agents, because that you need to get paid, right? And it would sell eventually. Well, that's now transitioned to, okay, I've got a lot of listings and what are we going to do with them now? You can't eat the listing agreement, right? Or you can't feed your family with it. So we've talked about, okay, focus on who's going to buy. Ask all the people in your, go through your phone and say, hey, are you thinking about buying? What would you buy right now? Just give me something and I'll go find it. Yeah. And work as a buyer's agent right now. And of course that will lead to listings too at some point, but work your listings and of course, you know, always work those. But if you just stick with the same way you've always been doing it, it's not going to work in times like this.
That's
it. You have
to
change it up.
For people
who's got the money.
Yeah, that's who's got the leverage.
The question.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the people who've listened, it sounds like you have so much knowledge, it's almost impossible to even scratch the surface in just like an hour-long conversation. Mm-hmm. But I always talk to people about how good your social is because you're always putting content out that's about what you're up to, what your family's up to, what the ag industry's doing, mm-hmm. tips and tricks about ag. How do people get access to that? What's the best way to like kind of continue to learn from your knowledge?
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. I love all the stuff you guys are doing too. So I steal some of your ideas every now and then.
Ours isn't as well produced as yours. No.
come on. Sully Gross for Instagram and then just Sullivan Gross at Facebook. I do have a Facebook account for business, but either one, both work. And of course I'm all over the internet, our website, so you can find me and reach out. I usually just leave my cell phone number in there. If people wanted to reach out, they could do that. And, I don't know if I guess I can give my phone number
if you want. It doesn't matter. They can find it.
Yeah. I've just,
yeah. And if they're
Google
interested,
Sullivan Gross, Pearson Realty, and you'll find
if they're serious about getting a good representative, they'll
the
put
step.
In the legwork.
And I will say, like, and I think you guys are the same way. I have a little bit of a soft spot for wanting to help younger people or even older people get into farming, because in the farming world, our just average age of the local farmer is continuing to climb. And of course, everyone wants to talk about the large companies that are coming in to buy farmland, which is fine. I think they're doing a lot of great things too for the land and the communities. But I love to see people be successful. And if I can help in that, and I tell people all the time, look, I don't even care if I'm involved with the deal. If you're buying something in some water area that you don't really know about, just call me and I'll tell you what I know or how to get the information. Or I'll tell you, I have no idea. You know, I'm sorry, I couldn't be helpful, but sales and water information is very important. So, I'm usually, willing to collaborate, of course, with lots of people on that.
Well, Sullivan, it was really good to have you on. First off,
it was great being on here. I've always heard about this famous podcast.
I don't know about that. Maybe more famous now that we've had.
Now that we've had you.
I'm glad I made the cut.
But it's good to have you on. We may have to bring you back on in 6 months to do an update, because if you're saying maybe there's a light here, I'd love to hear the come up story and say, hey, this is what changed to make it a brighter time frame. But thank you for coming on, man. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, it's been a blast.
Boom.
Thanks, guys.